I tried to pick a topic that could hopefully be of general interest, and I definitely made this a colloquium style, so it's meant to be a very physical presentation of the phenomena, some mathematical details, but try to give you a sense of this very important, very contemporary research topic. If you ask a plasma physicist, I'm a bona fide plasma physicist, if you ask a plasma physicist, what are the, say, top 10 most important problems in plasma physics? Probably magnetic reconnection would be in the top three. And so I'm going to try to sort of explain why this is such an important topic, and as sort of a general phenomenon in a sense, and applicable to in many physical situations. I've collaborated with this work quite extensively with Keiji Fujimoto. He's a postdoc of mine in my group. He just joined me about half a year ago at Kyoto University. And I also collaborated with a group of Ryan Brower in Bochum, Ruhr Universität. And I'll try to highlight sort of some of the things that we've sort of been working together on. So this is the outline. I first will give you sort of a some general discussion about the importance of magnetic fields. Of course, we know there's all kinds of energy in the universe, you know, dark energy and of course, kinetic energy. But there's a substantial amount of magnetic energy in the universe. And so magnetic reconnection is one avenue, what's one of the only ones really know of, in tapping into the magnetic energy and making that energy be converted into sort of high energy particles, et cetera. So I'll try to give you sort of a general picture of magnetic fields and speak of them in the context of plasmas. And then try to go some of the physical processes of magnetic reconnection. And I'll discuss the progress that was made in the early days of the topic using the magnetohydrodynamics, treating the electrically conducting fluid. And then I'll go discuss about more contemporary work in using multi-fluid magnetohydrodynamics. And finally, this is a topic, this is my major area of research right now, is on describing magnetic reconnection phenomena kinetically. And I'll try to show you why the magnetohydrodynamic model doesn't work. It's not a precise description of the phenomena. Magnetic reconnection can be made in the laboratory. There's a number of experiments going on, and I'll try to talk about some of the connections of the work to laboratory experiments. And then I'll try to end up with some open questions and some summary. OK, so I tried to just start with basically some type of range of magnetic fields that one would typically encounter in astrophysics. So we go to the very extreme edge. So more recently discovered magnetars by Duncan and Thompson. Magnetars are basically neutron stars rapidly rotating, but they have enormous magnetic fields. They have fields that are 10 to the 14 to the 10 to the 15 Gauss. And in case you're used to thinking of Tesla, is the conversion factor. So it's, we're talking some billions of Tesla. If one could tap into some of that magnetic energy, of course, one could generating quite a lot of high energy particles, for example. The other end is in a larger scale galaxy cluster. So typically, it's known through measurements that the magnetic field strength in the vicinity of galaxy clusters, for example, is kind of on the range of about 10 to the minus 5 Gauss. And again, since this is very large scale fields, if one could again tap into that source, it's a very large volume. So tapping into some percentage of that magnetic energy could potentially lead to, again, also high energy sort of phenomena. So if we come in a little closer to our sun, if you didn't believe the sun had magnetic fields, you certainly did after the trace satellite was turned on. It's a trace satellite basically imaged, I think it's mostly ultraviolet, range, but basically they Trace Satellite was able to actually image coronal loops, solar coronal loops. So this is not the top of somebody's hair at the head of the sun, obviously it's actually the surface of the sun, and you can see these enormous loop structures. It's very, very fascinating to watch the Trace movies. They actually have, if you go to the NASA website, Trace Satellite, you can see some very beautiful movies. These loops, well, they can dissipate their energy. I mean, if you actually look at some of the dynamics, these loops are actually like vibrating, like they're like guitar strings, or they vibrate. They're anchored, of course, in the photosphere here, but they vibrate, and then they also have a lot of magnetic energy, stored magnetic energy, and there's a lot of kinetic energy associated with these loops. And so magnetic reconnection is one way in which these loops can actually convert their magnetic energy into kinetic energy. And one of the challenges of solar physics is to actually explain the luminosity profiles along these loops. It's very non-uniform. There's a lot of high energy processes occurring when the charged particles, for example, come down in contact with the plasma in the photosphere. Of course, all these loops are embedded in a plasma. Right? So you have to think that there's a plasma which has a density, typically a number density of 10 to the 10 particles per cubic centimeters. Electron temperatures are about 2.5 million degrees Kelvin, and magnetic field here are about 200 Gauss. So again, enormous amounts of magnetic energy that's going to be stored in these loops. And if we move just a little bit closer, we see that plasma, you know, trapped in the geomagnetic field lines of the Earth. We, of course, in Canada, we have the front row seat to the Aurora Borealis, which is a product of the electron impact on the ionosphere of the Earth. It turns out that these charged particles, which produce the visible aurora, they actually originate from reconnection events in the Earth's magnetotail, which I'll show you a picture of. But it's not enough to make energy sufficient to impact into the ionosphere and cause the glowing of the aurora. You actually need, there's another particle accelerator at about 3,000 kilometers altitude on the geomagnetic field lines, which it kind of gives additional acceleration, which can cause the much more dynamic events and much more visible events. This is actually a satellite, one of the first satellite images which was taken of the aurora. So you can see the Earth here. This is the night, the day side. Here's the night side, and you can see nicely the old. This is just a cartoon. This is the real thing. So satellites can actually image the entire, you know, dynamics also of the full aurora oval. So these are kind of some examples of magnetic fields, plasmas trapped in magnetic fields. And of course, the subject of today's talk is to actually discuss how the magnetic field can convert that energy into particle energy. Before we talk about magnetic reconnection, we'll first talk about how the magnetic fields got there in the first place. Well, we don't exactly know in large scale galactic magnetic fields, we don't exactly know how they got there. They could have gotten there, say, cosmic strings, or some other seed must have started the magnetic field. And of course, then you have to have a dynamo process to actually keep the magnetic field, say, amplified and keep it to some value, some steady state value. And so we talk about generation of magnetic fields, and typically one involves the dynamo mechanism. So essentially, you get that from Faraday's law. So you have some kind of flow field, V, which would amplify some seed field. And so we have, for example, the Earth. Earth's magnetic field is created by a conducting fluid, for example, motion. And people can actually quite well simulate now the generation of Earth's magnetic field using sort of dynamo. Of course, they don't just use Faraday's law. They actually couple that is coupled to a momentum equation for the velocity field, etc. So there's a lot of physical processes which go in, but generally this is where the magnetic field generation comes in. And so this is kind of the picture. This is from a numerical simulation of this by Gary Glatzmeier's group in University of California. to Santa Barbara. So this is a dynamo problem for generation of magnetic fields. There are two kinds of dynamos. There are what are called kinematic dynamos. This is where you actually specify the velocity field, and then you basically solve, you evolve Faraday's law. Only certain kinds of flow fields can generate what are called fast dynamos. And typically, one class of flows, which are, say, chaotic flows, are able to generate fast dynamos. These have been worked on by people like Childress, Galloway, Frisch, and Arnold. And so this is where you have, but the problem is here, you have to actually specify, you kind of specify the flow. And more recently, people like Fausto Cattaneo in Chicago work on self-consistent dynamo generation, and this involves evolving Wenton equation. And the main goal is to actually see what is the saturation of the magnetic field evolution, and it turns out in many astrophysical dynamo situations, magnetic reconnection is one of the processes which actually kind of limits dynamo action. And so in this kind of picture we have is that basically turbulent or swirling plasma motion leads to magnetic field amplification, sort of dynamo process, and then we can actually have processes like magnetic reconnection which can convert the magnetic energy into plasma flow, heating, and particle acceleration. So you can actually sometimes think of reconnection, magnetic reconnection, as an anti-dynamo process. Sometimes that's one sort of way to frame consequences of it. So just to kind of, in words, a very somewhat precise definition. So magnetic reconnection is the process by which you have oppositely directed magnetic fields. You don't have to have all the components oppositely directed. You actually only need really one component oppositely directed. And if you force these oppositely directed fields together, this annihilation, basically field lines are broken and cross-connected. And as a result, because of the development of electric field structures, quite complex structures in the region where this annihilation is taking place, the very local region basically can affect, because of stresses, can actually affect the global magnetic topology. So if you're trying to do this conversion process from magnetic to kinetic energy, for example, one of the consequences will be also large-scale topological changes of the magnetic field. And so this is kind of the where one has to get into really kinetic processes. When we talk about particle acceleration, we're talking about sort of non-thermal distributions. And so this is where we can't really use the MHD model per se. People do sometimes use magnetic reconnection topology changes and try to study test particle motion in those magnetohydrodynamic fields, not considering the back reaction of the accelerated particle distribution on the reconnected field fields. And so people can have made some calculations of high energy acceleration in those fields. But one really, to do the problem right, you really have to have this back reaction of the plasma distribution basically on the field topology. So we have three main characteristics. We have magnetic topology changes, which change B. We have flows, which have associated with the velocity, and acceleration of particles, which are associated with, say, electric fields. So the main requirements, before we kind of go into examples, in order to have this magnetic reconnection phenomenon, you have to have this forcing together of oppositely directed components. So you have to have a proper magnetic topology to do that. You need localization in order to basically induce the dissipation. And you need you may be able to construct equilibria, which are stable, for example. So you often need some kind of symmetry breaking perturbation to actually kind of initiate the process. And so I'll kind of go through some of that stuff. some examples of those kind of perturbations we'd look at. So the first thing in reconnection sort of physics studies is you try to imagine, create physical situations in which you can have oppositely directed field components coming together. And so we can first look at the Earth situation. We know that, as I mentioned, the dynamo can create the magnetic field, and then we want to see how we can convert the magnetic energy back into kinetic energy, for example. So this is a picture of the interaction of the solar winds. So to lowest order, the Earth has a dipole magnetic field with a certain direction, field direction, that is in contact with a constant sort of steady solar wind blowing at us at about 400 kilometers per second. It's a supersonic flow decelerates, so there's actually a bow shock. So the number of structures in the magnetosphere, I just take out a few of the main ones. But basically, there are boundary layers that form. So this is where the magnetic pressure from the dipole field balances the pressure from the solar wind, which is the kinetic pressure. So there's a boundary layer that forms. But at that boundary layer, there actually is situations in which the magnetic field, which is embedded in the solar wind, so this, you can imagine that the sun, for example, has strong magnetic fields near the surface, but as the field falls off, it becomes much weaker, and then the plasma basically carries the magnetic field away. The field lines from the sun sort of carry away, forming the heliosphere, and that solar wind, the magnetic field embedded in the solar wind, actually has direction sometime anti-parallel to the Earth's dipole field, sometimes it's parallel. But there are many kind of situations in which the fields are actually anti-parallel. And the breaking and reconnecting of the field lines in this region here, in this sort of purplish region, that's where a lot of the solar wind, the charged particles from the sun, they actually get into the trap in the Earth's dipole field. That forms the Van Allen radiation belts, for example, is one class of particles. But a lot of particles can come in through this zone here. So that's a field of intense study.
Are the field lines to the solar wind really long and coherent?
Yeah, very huge. Yeah, the solar heliosphere is very large scale. You have to imagine that we're just like a little, very tiny object sitting in this large scale. So the actual, if you sort of view it from the top, the sun has like a pinwheel looking magnetic field pattern. It's got if you look at the magnetic field pattern in the sun radially, it looks like sort of a pinwheel. Okay, and this is being carried out by the solar wind.
You said it's changing direction, so is it something which is...
Yeah, because it's a pinwheel, so it has kind of a shape like this. So sometimes we see field components which are in the same direction as dipole, and sometimes they're opposite. This is actually just a 2D slice, but if you actually look at the 3D orientation, the field components can actually be parallel, anti-parallel. So it actually changes. The parts that come in contact with the Earth actually change from one polarity to the other.
It's not like you get pockets that are moving along through. The whole thing is bigger.
Right, yeah. So this is important. So a lot of dramatic changes occur when the solar wind polarity is opposite to the, that's when you get this huge amount of energy created here through this reconnection processes, for example. But when it's parallel, then if the flow is just deflected around it, so the field lines just sort of bend around. The other place in which the fields become anti-parallel, this is the area called the magnetotail, so it's on the sort of the night side. And so what happens here, basically plasma pressure is comparable to the magnetic pressure, and so you typically have the field lines are embedded in the flows, and so you usually one has sort of flows that sort of converge, and they basically force together the field in the tail region here, so that you can imagine the fields here basically merging can occur here. There's actually been satellite fly-throughs in these areas. I'll show some example later on. But basically, there's a sort of a squeezing effect here. And in fact, you get a significant conversion of magnetic energy here into kinetic energy This generates, flows away from the Earth and flows toward the Earth. And as I mentioned earlier, some of those charged particles that create the aurora borealis, for example, they are coming from the magnetic reconnection events here, which produce earthward flows. Okay, they come along these field lines here. And again, as I mentioned, around here, some 2,000 to 3,000 kilometers, there's another particle accelerator, which we don't actually fully understand how it works. But it actually accelerates the particles, the electrons, to much higher energies, and that's the ones that actually create the visible aurora. So there's sort of like two particle accelerators kind of working together.
The visible ones never come from the sun, so it's the thing you hear about.
Yes, that's a false. So if you sometimes read in magazines or books, they say, oh, the aurora borealis is created by charged particles coming from the sun. It's actually not really true. I mean, there are solar wind particles which get into the magnetosphere cavity, but in fact, the origin of the aurora is really from the magneto tail.
The ones that are just coming from the sun are not energetic enough?
They get trapped in these dipole field at the best. In sort of the best case, some of them might get trapped in the geomagnetic field. The others just deflect around. So they really don't contribute. So it's really coming from back here. That's the origin of the aurora.
And the reason it's usually at high latitudes is because the magnetic tail is pretty far out.
Correct. And that's why we're in this situation in northern latitudes. Those field lines are connected to the magnetic tail, to this sort of spot here. This is the kind of the region of what's called closed field lines, and then you have this region of open field lines, and it's this region between the two. That's the ones where they map into our auroral oval in northern latitudes. Okay, I'll just go through this quick. This is a kind of a side thing, is that people have realized since even like the late 70s, strictly at Los Alamos, where they have a large project involving satellites flying through the magneto tail, they actually observe what are called high energy plasmoids. They used to call them fireballs. But basically, the whole process of, so here's kind of the sequential numbers. One, this is the state of the magnetosphere at different times. So one, you go down 1 through 5 and 6 through down 10 here. So these are all the kind of topological changes which occur in magnetic reconnection events when you're actually releasing a whole bunch of kinetic energy, for example, these high-speed flows. So initially you get some, this pinching I was talking about, you get magnetic reconnection, you get flows toward the Earth, away from the Earth, and then these field lines are under very high stress. And so basically you kind of build up magnetic energy here enough to sort of, again, force together anti-parallel fields, and then again you form this kind of bubble which kind of forms. And it goes, because of the magnetic stresses, it gets pushed away from the Earth. And satellites actually, many satellites have flown through this bubble. It's a very high speed flow, talking hundreds of kilometers per second. So that's a huge amount of kinetic energy that's released because of this magnetic reconnection events.
What fraction of the time is that bubble there? Is it just...
It passes, this bubble moves at a velocity such that I think we're talking something on the order of about an hour to go through this sequence here. So it would be sort of an hour, roughly a half an hour to an hour time scale for this bubble to be produced and move tailward. And it goes about 60, 70 Earth radii, not even Earth radii, very far away. So you can imagine that the magnetosphere is kind of this like tear-shaped with a whole bunch of bubbly events. And magnetic reconnection is dominant against solar surface coronal loops, for example. Here's again, you just have to have imagination to understand how oppositely directed field components can come in contact with each other. Here's one example of a solar surface, a model proposed by Eric Priest at St. Andrews University in Scotland. He proposed a model. Sometimes these coronal loops, you sometimes see very bright spots, these X-ray emissions. See bright spots, some points along these, not the top of the loop, but on the sides. So he proposed a model which he basically had coronal loops which become heated, and they become very buoyant. They rise, And then you can have situations where the neighboring field lines have opposite polarity, and then you could form reconnection events and create a lot of high energy particles and also X associated X rays. So this is another example. One of the most studied is the solar flares. Shibata in Japan has proposed models which have come under a lot of scrutiny and passed many tests, the observational tests, for example. So here's again plasmoid formation now in a sort of chrono loop situation. So basically, you are flows directed toward these oppositely directed field components basically can cause pinching off high-speed flows, plasmoid formation, and then the flows can also come down here, and they can dump also a lot of hard X-rays at the top of the coronal loops, for example. So there's a lot of dynamical processes, and here's an example of an X-ray image, 1 kV, and this model was invoked to explain the bright spots near the tops of the loops as a sort of possibility for magnetic reconnection. This is from an observation in 1992. So there's a lot of things that could be understood through the reconnection model. It's kind of actually a standard. You can view it as a kind of a standard model of interpreting high energy events on solar and stellar atmospheres. There's even people speculating that in extrasolar planets, as you may know, that many of the planets that are being discovered are actually Jupiter-like planets, and they're actually closer to the sun than, say, like in our solar system. We, you know, we have other planets in between, but many of the planets discovered have Jupiter-like objects that are very close. And so they're so close that actually it's possible you could have some kind of magnetic linkage between the field lines from the planet cross-connecting with the solar ones. And this is a cartoon from Rubinstein and explaining, I guess, some anomalies in the that there might be some luminosity anomalies from high energy events occurring between the planets. Planet and star.
They actually see evidence that there's something happening between these?
Apparently, yes. There's some emission that they can see. I'm not really that familiar with the observation of these, but they're trying to explain some emission, and they were invoking the magnetic reconnection process as one possibility.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess I was going to ask the same question from the viewpoint of somebody in this solar system. This would be a really bright thing.
Yes, like yes, it could be very dangerous. Of course, this could be a catastrophic event, which would then beg the question, you know, if there were any life, you know, life would be harsh, right? So, yeah.
The reason they can see this past the star is that these are X-rays or something that you
need. Yeah, there's some high energy. These are high energy events, yeah. Okay, so let's now talk a little bit about how you would approach modeling this kind of magnetic field annihilation process within the framework of magnetic hydrodynamics. So without sort of going through the whole details of magnetic hydrodynamics, I really focus really on Ohm's law, ideal Ohm's law, where we have what's called emotional electric field. So this is for a superconducting fluid, magnetic field embedded in it. And so this ideal Ohm's is essentially the equation of motion of that, fundamental equation of motion. So it's very fascinating that the velocity is determined directly by the local electric magnetic fields. Okay, so it's not like we're using, you know, any of Newton's laws to do. We just say that we have the local electric and magnetic field. We know what the velocity is. So you can think of this as like the basic equation of motion. The thing to notice here is that there's no mass and there's no charge. So it doesn't matter what charged particles you have there, they're going to move in exactly the same way. And so this is why in this medium in which you have a magnetic field embedded in the fluid, the fluid moves along, carries the magnetic field with it, so the magnetic field is frozen into the fluid. And so if you basically, all the part, if it's electrons or protons, for example, they're all going to move the same way. And so this is this basis of the one fluid, single fluid, Magneto hydrodynamic picture. Now, this is what is for the ideal Magneto hydrodynamic system. But of course, we have situations in which we can have dissipation. And so we have an Ohm's law, which they, for example, could have a resistivity. So then you have now a relation built between currents and electric fields. Electrical resistivity could come in the form of electron-ion two-body interactions, collisions, for example. But if you're in a collisionless medium, like all, a lot of examples I showed you, the mean free path is thousands and thousands of kilometers, right? So the classical resistivity is almost totally negligible. So it's dominated really by this E is equal to minus V cos V term. Now, there are other terms there's a more general framework of Ohm's law, and we'll get into that later, and that plays a vital role in the physics of magnetic reconnection. So if you working within the ideal Ohm's law, and you try to force together anti-parallel field components, magnetic flux is invariant, so time rate of change is zero. And so you actually will not get any magnetic reconnection. Basically, you'll just form a sort of current singularity in a sense. And so you can never have the field basically form a reconnection, have any reconnection, reconnected component. And so if you have electrical resistivity or other non-ideal terms, you can then induce magnetic reconnection. Okay, so we have two kind of spatial structures associated with reconnection, and two kinds of scenarios. So one is we could basically, through flows, basically force these field components to annihilate each other, and we could have reconnection, so we could have field lines cross and reconnect. So typically we would have the flows coming in here, reconnection, field lines break and reconnect, and then you would have the field, these fields basically flowing off to the right and to the left. So you could imagine building sort of a steady state if you had a certain inflow, and then this would be your outflow. And remember, the field would be far away from this reconnection point. The field would be frozen into the plasma, so it would flow outwards here and carry the field with it. This other situation can occur is where you force the fields together. You form very localized currents, which could generate instabilities. And sometimes we call these filamentation instabilities, because basically you can actually force, this is through a kind of an instability process, you can actually have the filamentation of a current. And you could form these magnetic vortices. And because these currents are flowing in the same direction, they'll basically attract each other, and you could have a coalescence and secondary sort of reconnection. So I'll make some comment about this maybe later on, but I'll be focusing mostly on this forced reconnection scenario, because that's the one that's most typically used in sort of interpretation of observations. Okay, now the idea of converting magnetic energy into kinetic energy goes back to Giovanelli, Italian physicist, in 1947. So it was kind of proposed, but nobody really knew how that energy could be extracted from the magnetic field or put into the particle kinetic energy, for example. So the first progress that was really made in reconnection, we say microphysics, was by Robert Sweet and Eugene Parker in Chicago. These two papers, this is, I think, in Nuovo Cimento, is it? And the other one is in Astrophysical Journal. These two papers came out and tried to build a model of this process of reconnection and conversion of energy. So what they imagined is that you basically have this inflow topology like this, and unfortunately, I can't go through all the details, but basically you could just use conservation lots. So you can use basically, you have a kind of like a pipe here almost. You have a flow in and you have flow out. So you basically can use continuity and conservation relations to derive this relation. It's a basically a geometrical factor which relates the inflow and the outflow. So here Vn is in this direction and Vout is in this direction. And so essentially you form a kind of a nozzle configuration, and magnetic field energy is getting converted into flow energy here, and over a certain length L, this is a nozzle has a certain width, and the inflow is related to the outflow by this inflow is related to this product of the this length, this width divided by length times the outflow. This outflow is the maximum it could be is what's called the Alphane speed. So you have to imagine like the Alphane speed is like the speed at which information is carried. Like we have magnetic fields and perturbations propagate at what's known as the Alphane speed. Flows, there's also a flow upper bound is the Alphane speed. So it's a fraction of the speed of light. Typically it's 100 to 300 kilometers per second, but that's basically the maximum flow speed that you can have exiting this nozzle here. So that's kind of what the outflow speed is. And so by using these conservation laws, you work out that this ratio, aspect ratio of this nozzle is related then to what's called the Lundquist number. And Lundquist number is basically a ratio of the magnetic diffusion in this layer divided by the Alphane time. And so the magnetic diffusion time is typically a very, very large number compared to, say, the Alphane time, which is the time it takes for Alphane waves, which is the normal mode of the plasma medium, to propagate. So typically this number is very large. We're talking about something that's very tenth big. Sometimes it's like associated with the magnetic Reynolds number, if you like it, if you discuss it in the context of turbulence. So this is a very, 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 very large number. And so the original model would predict, because the square root, whatever square root of S is related to this ratio W over L, so it predicts there a very, very large kind of nozzle, basically. And if you work out the time scale to reconnect this, dissipate this magnetic flux, or have this reconnection rate, it would be days or weeks, okay, to dissipate the magnetic energy. And so this model was actually a failure when it actually was proposed, although it seemed to have a lot of the correct elements, but basically the model predicts too slow a rate of magnetic reconnection. You can't deposit the energy in a short time scale, because in this whole business, you have to be able to explain time scales that are ordered like seconds, 30, 40 seconds. That's how, when you have, for example, solar flare events, on the, those things are, energetic events that are happening on a very, very short time scale. So you have to have something that cannot be sort of longer than, say, an hour, 2 hours, because that's sort of, that's the time scale we're talking about here. But this prediction of this, through this model was way off. So this led to another study, and this is, again, a huge breakthrough in a sense, because it's sometimes called the Petchek model, after Harry Petchek. And he proposed a model in which essentially you didn't form this kind of nozzle, very long nozzle. It actually formed a very, very small, we call X point. And the flow, it's almost like having two supersonic flows come together. And basically, the energy is carried off in a shockwave. And so these dark lines here are basically a description of the shock fan, if you like. So all the energy is kind of carried away along this shock front, because this flow is supersonic for these magnetic perturbations that do the communication. The information is propagating across the magnetic field through these Alphane fluctuations. And so those are supersonic. And so The dotted lines are the actual flows. This is the kind of analytical solution that Petrick proposed. This is the actual flows, these dotted lines. Okay, so this is the flow pattern, and then there's solid lines here with arrows. That's the magnetic field lines. But you see that the diffusion region here is almost negligible here. And he was able to generate an inflow relation to the outflow by 1 over the logarithm of S, which was like, say, 10 to the 8. So he's essentially getting a fraction, you know, 0.1 or so of the Alfvén speed, which is a very large speed and is puts you in the right time scale to dissipate this energy very quickly. Okay, so this model was highly exciting in the 1964s, 65, and so, but the problem was that this model actually has never been realized in numerical simulation studies, or nobody has been able to generate a Petrick reconnection configuration with the shocks. It turns out that there's a fundamental flaw in the construction of this model, is that the resistivity, he held the resistivity constant throughout the volume. And it turns out that non-uniform resistivity develops once you form this kind of a flow and magnetic field pattern. And this is now confirmed in numerical studies. So this configuration actually never forms. And we'll see some examples of how the situation changes very much when you do the microphysics kinetically. Now, one thing which I just want to mention is that this is a slight change here. And I'm going to kind of relate a little bit of this magnetic reconnection and dissipation of magnetic energy into what's called current sheet formation, because that's one of the key things which forms whenever you consider this kind of forced scenario like this. It actually turns out that you actually form current sheets, very narrow, concentrated currents in this layer. And there have been questions in the community as to whether or not these current sheets would form singularities, or if they would be actually, sort of, if the current sheets would actually be singular, and if these singularities would be what are called finite time singularities. So people were quite interested to know whether you could actually get finite time singularities forming in two-dimensional magnetic hydrodynamics. It has been known for a while that in two-dimensional neutral fluids, either flows, you cannot form finite time singularities. People have shown that you can do that in three dimensions, but in two dimensions, it's proven mathematically you can't form them. Three dimensions, it has been shown now that they can form. People wanted to investigate the same situation in magnetic hydrodynamics. So it turns out in two-dimensional magnetic hydrodynamics, you can't form finite time singularities. These singularities actually grow only exponentially. A finite time singularity would grow like 1 over t naught minus t to some power. Okay, so it really becomes a singular function of time. So the best that people have been able to get together from two-dimensional magnetic dynamics is that you can't form finite time singularities, but you can form exponentially throwing in time singular current sheets. And these have a lot of connection to magnetic reconnection, where you're actually having the field lines being forced together, that you actually form a current sheet, but you form it exponentially in time. You can't form it as it's not a singular development. Here's an example from Dieter Biscamp. I'm spelling his name wrong. Dieter Biscamp from Germany, Max Planck Institute, showed nicely that if you take smooth initial data. Okay, so here's the flux function that's initialized. It's basically a sum of these cosines. In neutral fluids, there's something called a Taylor vortex. This is kind of similar to that initial condition. But anyway, this kind of initial smooth initial data actually forms these very localized currents. So this right panel is the flux function psi, which is related to the magnetic field, of course. This is a scalar variable. So psi is a function of x and y. It's two dimensions. you see the evolution of the flux function here, these two panels, and the corresponding current density, J, its spatial pattern. So you see here that for this pattern, you form essentially four current sheets, very localized here. And later time, you see they become much more narrower. And more modern current sheets can actually be unstable. So you can see here, later times, if you follow that simulation longer, you get filamentation. So you see that this is kind of this instability which forms. You have these very long, thin current sheets, and they actually are unstable. And they generate these current filaments. And you can see also that this is the flux function. This is the current density. You see that you also get very elongated current filaments, and they even have, there's actually even folding as well. This is something that one can explain in MHD turbulence, basically, two dimensions, that you get also this kind of folding process. But you see that it's kind of breaking up. That was not using very high resolution numerical simulation. So Rainer Brauer, one of my collaborators, he has developed a 2D MHD simulations with what's called adaptive mesh refinement. Basically, the mesh kind of self-adapts to the development of a singularity, so you have very, very high resolution. And so here's showing the vorticity, and here's the grids that develop around each of these current sheets. So here's the current density, and here's the vorticity patterns. And you see here that very clearly the current versus time is only developing exponentially. It's not a finite time singularity. You cannot develop a finite time singular flow. And this is consistent with some scaling arguments as well. So this localization of current and its stability is a crucial issue in the evolution of magnetic connection. So here I'm going to show you some now more recent progress in this problem. So the difficulty was in the magnetohydrodynamic model, the single fluid model, it was not easy to get what's called fast magnetic connection. So people turned to two fluid magnetohydrodynamics, and here I'll show you the magnetohydrodynamic equations now. So basically you take an electron fluid, an ion fluid, so you have two continuity equations, one for each species. Here's the momentum equation. Momentum is determined by the pressure gradients and the building up in the electron ion channel, and there's the J cross B force. And then you have the Faraday's law, and the current is related to the magnetic field through Ampere. And of course now, your Ohm's law is not simply this idea, you have this ideal term, this resistive term, which actually turns out to be negligibly small. It plays almost no role, so we can actually ignore it compared to these other terms. This term is called the Hall term. And this is the electron inertia term. These are higher order terms in the Ohm's law. We actually don't, to be quite frank, we actually don't have a proper Ohm's law for a electrically conducting fluid within the context of nonlinear magnetohydrodynamics. Nobody is able to write down a proper form of the Ohm's law. So that's kind of one of the major kind of research questions, how to build one. But this is the kind of framework with which we sort of start our studies with. So those simulation calculations, so trying to understand the dynamic reconnection process, this is work done by Jim Drake at University of Maryland. These are some of his results. And it was quite exciting because in the 90s it was realized that if you actually attack this reconnection problem with two fluid, you could actually form what's called a dual current sheet structure. So you had a narrow current sheet, right, embedded in the reconnection zone. So here, imagine we're forcing together antiferro field components. You form a nice current sheet locally here. So you have flow coming in, it's being reconnection occurring, and then you have flow outward. But the ions responded differently than electrons because when you're working with these terms in the Ohm's law, the inertia terms and the Hall terms, you're actually describing really the slippage of the fluid and the magnetic field at the small scale. So in small scales, these terms become very, very big. And then you actually break the fluids apart, in a sense, and then each one evolves independently. And so this realization was that you could develop then very large electric fields now in the vicinity through polarization effects, right? Electrons lines are now decoupled, so you could form polarization electric fields, and that would induce currents flowing in this direction into the board. And then you could actually perhaps enhance the reconnection rates. In fact, that's what was observed, that one could observe reconnection rates, which were now consistent with more observations. But the problem with the model is we're still working with a fluid model. So it's assumed that when you construct the fluid, you take moments of a velocity distribution. It's assumed that the moments are such that you're keeping the distribution function, say, as a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, right? You take moments of that. That's how you get those two fluid equations. But it's not guaranteed with all this electric fields, et cetera, that you could generate very non-thermal particle distributions. And so taking the moments, you would not have the correct fluid equations, because your closure is cut off only, it's only like a 2 or 3 moment closure. You'd have to, you know, if the distribution functions were very non-thermal, you might have to, you know, may have to take 50 to 100 moments to close the equations, right? So this closure here was a very simple one. The pressure is just related to the product of the density and temperature. So, and we'll demonstrate that in this kind of final section of my talk on kinetic magnetic reconnection. So macroscopically, we have the MHD picture with, say, some dissipative process. It could be classical resistivity, but in most astrophysical cases, it's really these Hall terms in the Ohm's law and inertial terms. And so one would have to, you know, do the problem, the microscopic dynamics, you'd have to actually solve for the self-consistent particle equations of motion in addition to Maxwell equations. And so when we do kinetic simulations, we solve Maxwell's equations and update the particle positions and momentum using, say, the relativistic equations of motion self-consistently. Each simulation particle is not a single particle, it's actually a cloud. We use kind of, don't use point particles, we use charged clouds, because it's not possible to represent the real number of charged particles. It would be impossible to solve for the, you know, billions and billions of particles there. So we solve basically sort of Gaussian type superparticles, Gaussian shaped superparticles. And those represent millions of particles. So what we're looking for then is basically energy conversion between, say, magnetic energy and the pointing flux, and also the work done by the particles on the fields is represented by this E dot J term. So electrodynamically, we're kind of looking at interactions between the electromagnetic fields and the particles. So this is what we, again, similar configuration as I was describing before. And so now what we're trying to see is basically, again, how the electron species and ion species time evolve in this reconnection layer. So we expect to have an electron current layer, and then there'll be an ion, corresponding ion current layer. And then what we're trying to look at is basically, what is this aspect ratio? Because it turns out from the studies we've been making, we get nothing like the Petchek, the shock type model. We don't get anything like that. But we get something that looks like this Sweet Parker kind of nozzle. But the nozzle, the aspect ratio is very, very, it's sort of like almost like a 5-to-1 ratio, it turns out, in our calculations. So we don't get this, you know, enormous nozzle that would be predicted from the Sweet Parker model. So the kinetic length scales come in, and they actually shrink the layer in such that it's much more like an aspect ratio, looks something like that. And this is in the regime of fast reconnection. So again, here's the kind of scenario, is that we actually form a current, this current layer, because of the polarization effects coming in and this causes currents flowing, kind of a current, you have a small scale current layer embedded in the region where you have the antiparallel fields. And now I'll show you a movie. Let's see, so this is the top panel is, I think, the current density. The white lines are the magnetic field lines. The color scale here is magnitude, so blue. So you have red to blue. These are both increasing in plus and minus direction. That's the current. And at the bottom, you'll see the development of the ferroelectric field. And this is the one that would be basically accelerating the particles in this plane, in the board.
The current density is color-coded?
The current density is color-coded.
So I can't see the numbers. Would they all look to me? So what, red is high, blue is low?
That's right, yeah. So this is like minus 0.02. And this is, yeah, high. Yeah, that's right. So that's high current density. That's your current layer.
So it's a geometry is it that it's moving, the current moving?
Yes. So imagine that you have the up here. Sorry, I don't have arrows on this plot. But the upper part of the plane, the magnetic field component is to the right. And on the bottom plane, it's to the left. Okay, so there.
What direction is the current?
The current is coming under the plane. Yeah, because you know from your electrodynamics that this that current here is going to generate a magnetic field in the XY plane. So what we're going to see here is this current layer, how it's going to develop structure, and then we're going to see the inflow here balanced by the outflow, but on a sort of aspect ratio, which I was kind of explaining earlier. And this is the paraelectric field. So that the changes of the current will come from the development of this paraelectric field. Okay, because of this Hall terms and these polarization fields that develop in this XY plane. So you'll see very large enhancement of the paraelectric field. So if I...
the lines at the bottom one are also paraelectric field.
Yes, yeah. Okay, so let's... Okay, so... Yeah, so kind of slowly starts, and then once we get, now you see reconnection occurs. So that magnetic field lines are broken and reconnected here. And then you start to see now, see the flow coming in and the flow going out. And so this is this narrow current layer that's developed here. So Sweet Parker would predict enormously long, I mean, many, many times the length of this room would predict a layer like that. And you can imagine that it would take so long for the flow to go in and then come back out. The time scales are just way off. But you can see that we develop a narrow current layer here, a finite with an aspect ratio. I think this in this case it was like 10 to 1. So it's 10 times longer than it is across. But you see here that we've also developed large paraelectric fields. These blue and red indicate the paraelectric field, which has developed, and that's the one that's accelerating the particles to create this current, that current layer there. But there's also fluctuations in this paraelectric field. There's actually turbulence, et cetera. So it's got more structure, which we can go to. Now, you have to appreciate this computation is kind of what I call state of the art in the sense that we've figured out a way to actually make adaptive mesh refinement on this problem with these particles and currents. Enormously difficult problem. So, but it actually works. And just to show you how this is the grid, the computational grid. And you can see here how it self-adapts to the actual formation of the localized structures. So I'll just run this. So the top panel is the same thing you've seen before, but I actually now show the animation of the grid, and it's changing in time.
So this is not having regular hydrodynamics.
This is kinetic, fully kinetic. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, but still two dimensions, and we've just started the three dimensional construct. We've got the three dimensional model constructed, and now we're just doing testing. Okay, where's the okay, so you can see that you don't need such a fine grid in these regions here because nothing much interesting is happening. What you want to do is concentrate all your mesh points here, And so you can see now that the grid will start to basically conform to the geometry of the localized current layer. So you see here many more grid cells. So we do sort of these, you know, sublevels of refinement. We start with a level zero refinement, and we actually go down to finer and finer mesh. And you can see that the mesh conforms beautifully with the with these almost singular flow, a singular current. It's the same kind of problem that people have in numerical relativity when they want to study, say, for example, black hole coalescence. Everybody uses AMR techniques. That's the only way you can really control the numerics and do the high resolution calculations.
And initial flow, you have the electrons and the ions are going in opposite directions. Is that
electrons, yes, that's right. And so here's a plot of the distribution function in the in this direction in under the plane. And this demonstrates, this kind of proves that you cannot use magnetohydrodynamics. You make a huge error because look at this electron distribution function. This has become, you know, very substantially heated. It's got a very large tail, so you've accelerated a lot of particles to very large energies, and the ions have also not like a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. There's some non-thermal component that develops. So, and you can see that the flow speeds here are about 5 or 6 times the L-phase speed. Whereas you saw that earlier with the Stephen Petrek, you can only get about 0.1 times the L-phase speed. So kinetic matter-magnetic reconnection even makes things faster and more violent, in a sense. And again, yeah, this is just the reconnection electric field. If you take that E divided by B, that's a velocity. And that's divided by the L-phase speed. So we get kind of reconnection electric fields, which generate up to 1.5 the L-phase speed, so as the time evolution goes on. So just about finished, last two slides here. Right now, we're trying to do these calculations in three dimensions. So these are actually quite fresh. I mean, these are only, you know, we're talking months old results. That's always exciting for me to talk about some very really recent results. But we're trying to do three-dimensional calculations. Because we also expect that the current sheet, this current layer, is not stable. It's actually very turbulent. And these are borne out in results by Jim Drake's group, when they solve the two fluid MHD equations, they find actually there are instabilities which develop, which are in the third dimension, which we're not following right now. We follow the particle velocity in that dimension, but we don't follow the spatial structures. And so we expect to have more sort of anomalous resistivity, if you will, build up. And this will enhance the reconnection rate. So that's kind of an active area. I'll kind of skip that. It's kind of more observational. Just this last thing on laboratory experiments. So at Princeton, there's a very interesting experiment we're trying closely to model. This is the MRX, the magnetic reconnection experiment. So they actually use flux cores to actually generate an X point type topology, and they embed this in a plasma, so they get something that looks like a current layer. If you actually go in the R direction, so this is across up and down here in this X line, this is the plot of their current, that's the measured data, and then from that they have a magnetic field which they also measure, and so they have this nice current layer, and this is a magnetic field reversal, so this is the BZ component as a function of R. Okay, so you have this classic anti-parallel field. So this is there's actually a mathematical fit to this. This is a hyperbolic tangent function, and the Ampere's law relates the current to the magnetic field, and so this is like a hyperbolic secant squared. That's the relation to this hyperbolic tangent. Mathematically, these are related. And so the experimentally they can generate this very well and characterize the magnetic flux. And what's very interesting is that, well, they're not using very high Lundquist numbers, only 10 to the 3. Real world is 10 to the 8, or I mean, in astrophysics, typically it's like 5 orders of magnitude higher. But anyway, we still can learn a lot. These are the parameters of their experiment. They have very high densities compared to the real densities in astrophysics. But what they do find is very interesting is that they find that there's enhanced kind of what's called anomalous resistivity. So there's a kind of a base classical resistivity they have in their experiment because they're using fairly high densities. So this eta term in the Ohm's law is not so negligible. But when they make the temperature higher, basically, and increase the mean free path of the particles, they actually go into a regime here in which the plasma is more collisionless, and so the resistivity becomes anomalously high. And this is a hydrogen deuterium plasma. But they see already evidence of anomalous resistivity. And that anomalous resistivity would be coming from turbulence and waves, not from classical electron ion collisions. Okay, so it's resistivity coming from wave particle interactions. And the key question is, what are those waves? What is that turbulence? And that's a key thing. If we can actually characterize that, we may be able to scale that up to astrophysical systems. So here's my last slide, just a summary. I had some interesting and contemporary research questions. So we have now, clearly we can say that magnetic reconnection with just sort of classical ohmic resistance, for example, is far too slow to explain the time scales or induce what's called fast reconnection. Fast reconnection rates are possible if you have a kinetic layer, where when you have decoupling of the electron and ion motion. This induces fast flows, you have plasma heating and acceleration. The three-dimensional effects is what we have to seriously study now, because there's a possibility that one can generate more anomalous resistivity from the three-dimensional effects. And so this will help us to build kind of a first principles model of this anomalous resistivity. If we could actually make, so the goal is if we could build a phenomenological model from nonlinear simulation calculations, we could then try to have people who do global magnetohydrodynamic calculations try to use that that model for the resistivity. And right now, you have to appreciate that when people do astrophysical simulation, be it like accretion disks, like the momentum transport and accretion disks, or they do various instabilities in many astrophysical models, people using magnetohydrodynamics, they're actually not they are not describing the small scale physics correctly. If they don't describe that correctly, you can almost hardly believe their large scale patterns of the magnetic topologies. So, and people who are actually doing like early simulations of solar physical phenomena, even nowadays too, their source of resistivity is coming from the numerical grid. They cannot resolve these very, very small scales. So you can't really trust those calculations. You can put anything in there, right? It can give you whatever comes out. And then you can interpret it, but it's not really the real thing. So we have to really be careful and you have to be very critical of people who promote calculations with global magnetohydrodynamic models. And so I think that this reconnection is just an example of how much error, how badly you can be modeling things, right? And so you have to somehow put this small scale kinetic microphysics into a resistivity or viscosity. In fact, that's the next thing you have to also study, what is the viscosity? And so that's kind of one of the main research areas, and this is what Rainer Brauer and his group and mine, we're trying to actually see if we can do some kind of embedding method of kinetic model embedded into a magnetohydrodynamic model. So in the magnetohydrodynamic model, you'd have a cell, and then we would have, say, some sub-resolution coming from the kinetic model. And try to do that properly. So we're trying to look into this, how this can be done. And of course, there's more data coming out from satellite observations, multiple satellites now flying through various reconnection zones. And also another big challenge is how to scale what we know, what we can learn to astrophysical systems. Because when we actually try to scale some of these scenarios, which I'm describing here, to real astrophysical systems, we're off by like four orders of magnitude. So there's something clearly missing in our correct description of the rates of magnetic reconnection. So I hope by conviction this is probably one of the top three problems in plasma physics and in the topic of what's called plasma astrophysics, which which is kind of is being worked on right now. Okay, thanks for coming to the talk.
Yeah. Things where you're getting jets of.
Yes, right. Yeah, you want to convert the momentum.
Is the energy source there known to be something like the
reconnector? They have people talk about this, what's called magnetorotational instability. There are actually instabilities which are not really related to this, but in the nonlinear state of the instabilities, they actually find reconnection zones. Which is one of the ways in which they're dissipating things. So you have to appreciate that magnetic reconnection, and I kind of threw in that development of singular flows, singular current sheets, as you have to appreciate that that's the major way you can take large scale energy and cascade it down to small scales, and then magnetic reconnection or some other processes would form the dissipation scale. So if you kind of maybe take this little kind of model I've been describing and import it into magnetohydrodynamic turbulence, which is what you need to study problems like this, these accretion disks and transport of momentum, you have to have some way of taking large scales and cascading down to small scales. And there's this magnetic reconnection generation of opposite polarities. That's one way in which the MHD fluid can basically dissipate. So that's an instability which they invoke to convert or to cause a momentum transport and then have it basically the things kind of wind up and produce the jet. So there's sort of a rotational aspect. There's a lot of rotational aspect of the helical motion associated with this. This kind of process. So I didn't want to go into that too much, but that is, whenever you're doing the nonlinear magnetic hydrodynamics, inevitably these small scales form and you can dissipate them very effectively through these reconnection or current layers. But they can form in that case as well. But I've looked at those calculations people do, and again, it's all magnetic hydrodynamic single fluid, so I don't think they're actually correctly or modeling very well the small scales, that there's stuff that's kind of washed out in their calculations. So you always have to look at what Reynolds number they're running at. So typically modern MHD calculations run at S of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4. Okay, but they're really, really, it's more like 10 to the 10, 10 to 11 is what's typically required. And so there are many orders of magnitude away from where they have to be to resolve this full range of scales.
So, thank you very much for.